Lecture 10, Regulation to Ensure Free Markets.
A major theme of these lectures has been that the forces of competition and selfishness can produce very good outcomes for society as a whole. We can think of the selfishness of the consumer who's out there trying to buy the best product they can for the hard-earned dollar. We can think of the selfishness of the producer who's trying to get customers and make sales by producing high-quality products. We've argued that somehow an invisible hand guides these folks in many cases to do things that are for the betterment of society as a whole. Now, certainly, there are cases like positive and negative externalities. There are cases like poverty and inequality where the force of self-interest goes astray, and it leads us in directions we might not want to end up. But we can deal with those in particular ways, through particular targeted interventions. And we don't need to overthrow the market as a whole or dismantle capitalism in order to deal with them. But why is it exactly that the force of selfishness, always in these economic stories, seems to be used for the public good? After all, isn't it equally possible that the force of selfishness might be used for destructive purposes? Well, Vilfredo Pareto, a famous Italian economist around the turn of the century, once wrote that the efforts of men are utilized in two different ways. They are directed to the production or transformation of economic goods, or else to the appropriation of goods produced by others. It's worth remembering that thought. We can direct our energies toward making things ourselves, or we could direct them toward stealing from other people. What about that kind of selfishness? What about the ability of selfishness to produce things that we would think of as not very productive economically? This lecture works through a variety of cases where selfishness might come together in a way that we don't like for the good of society as a whole. For example, a group of producers might all band together, and instead of competing with each other to lower prices and raise quality, those people might all band together and raise prices, and by avoiding competition with each other, manage to make higher profits without benefiting the consumer. We could imagine a monopolist having a situation where, in order to sell certain goods, they would require that people buy other goods. They would tie their goods together in bundles and say that if you want to buy one good, well, you're going to have to buy these other goods as well. And that's the accusation made against Microsoft in these last few years. We could imagine companies lying about quality, promising a high-quality product but delivering a low-quality product. We could imagine companies polluting, as we talked about before. We can also imagine companies taking advantage of limited information. By taking advantage of limited information, they could, for example, try and sell you something that wasn't quite what you thought it was. And you might believe you were getting the product you wanted and find out that it really wasn't the product you wanted at all. All of these difficulties of banding together and limited information are issues which are going to come up in markets in many different contexts. And we need to think about what the role of government might be in helping the market function well in these different situations. Let's begin by thinking about the problem of monopoly and restricted competition. The first thing to say about monopoly, which is just the case when one firm controls the market, one firm owns everything that produces all of a given good in the market, is that sometimes monopoly is a good thing. Sometimes we give monopolies in the market as a reward. And the obvious example here, which we talked about in lecture number 8, is the case of a patent, where a patent is just a government-granted monopoly. It's the government saying, you have a monopoly on this product for the next 14 or 17 or 20 years, and because you have that patent, no one is allowed to compete with you. We give that monopoly in order to encourage innovation and encourage research and development. So, in that sense, monopoly can sometimes be a good thing. Moreover, whenever someone invents a new product, at least for a short period of time, until other people have managed to copy the product or figure out how to compete with it, they have a monopoly in the short term. And that idea of having a monopoly in the short term is clearly something which encourages people to produce more and encourages them to greater heights of innovation and of the higher quality. So in that sense, if somebody is making profits because they've produced a new product and because they've created something new, then those profits are economically, they make some sense. They serve a social function. They serve as an incentive for the kinds of innovation and research and development that we'd like to see. So in those cases, if you saw a monopoly or restricted competition, you might say, well, hey, that's a price we pay for progress. When does monopoly and restricted competition turn into a problem? Well, presumably, it starts to turn into a problem when we're not talking about innovation anymore, when we're not talking about a better product, when we're just talking about companies banding together, not to offer a new product, but simply to raise prices. One of the most famous quotations among economists on this process is from Adam Smith in his Wealth of Nations. Smith was wonderfully cynical in a friendly, humorous way about the human condition. In the Wealth of Nations, at one point, he wrote, "People of the same trade seldom meet together, even for merriment and diversion, but their conversation ends in a conspiracy against the public or in some contrivance to raise prices." For people who think that Smith always believed in capitalists and businessmen and always supported businessmen, I think this kind of cynical quotation is a wonderful leavening. Smith clearly believed, if you get a whole bunch of businessmen together, the first thing you know, they're all sitting around saying, "Hey, you know, if we didn't compete with each other, we could all make more money. Why don't we figure out a way not to compete with each other?" And in fact, that's something that businessmen have been doing on and off for long, long periods of time. The difficulty, of course, is that if everyone gets together and decides not to compete against each other, then they have no discipline from the other people who are producing in that market. Instead of saying, "My word, I have to keep my prices low because other people will undercut me," now it's just, "Well, hey, I'll raise my price, you raise your price, everybody raise their price, we'll all make higher profits, and we don't have to worry about being undercut by each other." The result in this situation would be that consumers are paying more for the product, and the companies can be as inefficient as they want to be. Another famous comment from an economist about monopoly is that the best thing about a monopoly is that you have a quiet life. If you're in a competing firm, you really have to worry that people are going to come in, they're going to steal your market, they're going to undercut you, they're going to take away things. But if you're a monopolist, if you've got an agreement with all the other firms, you just sit back, let the money come in, and just don't worry too much about things. In that situation, we would say consumers are being taken advantage of. The market is not working to provide the best value for people. It's working to provide profits for big companies instead. So what do we do about that situation? How do we address that situation when it comes up? Well, the straightforward answer is through what's called antitrust law. Back at the end of the 19th century, there were big combinations of firms where all the stock of those firms were held in common by one trust. And that trust might own the controlling interest of stock in many, many companies. So when laws were passed to break up these big trusts, as they were called, it was called antitrust legislation. And that term antitrust is now carried over to any time we talk about breaking up a big company, even if it's not officially a trust, that might be reducing competition. The government has the power, through various laws, through the Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission, to sue companies that it believes are restraining competition. As part of this power, the government also has rules which say that if you are planning on buying another large company, you have to announce it in advance, you have to tell the government in advance, and the government has to be able to approve of it. That sounds, in a way, very anti-free market, and in some sense it is. It's saying that the government has a role to play in encouraging competition. Now, sometimes these calls, I think, are at least what I would call relatively easy. For example, a few years ago, there was a proposal that Pepsi should buy 7-Up and that Coke should buy Dr. Pepper. This would have meant that the first and third largest soft drink companies were merging together, and the second and fourth largest soft drink companies in the U.S. were merging together. Clearly less competition as a result. And clearly the Federal Trade Commission, when this was announced, said, "We don't think so. You're not going to do this. Just don't even bother." Other cases are more difficult. Perhaps the two most famous antitrust cases in recent years, that is over the last few decades, are the cases involving AT&T and IBM. IBM's case started in the early 1970s and dragged on, with drag being the operative verb, dragged and dragged on for 13 full years. And at the end, the government dropped the case and nothing particular happened. The accusation at the beginning of the case was that IBM controlled the market for mainframe computers. It had about 90% of that market. And that it was taking unfair advantage of that by forcing people who bought the mainframe computers also to buy other things. So it was using its monopoly in mainframes to tie it to other purchases of other items. This went on and on and on and on, and by the mid-1980s, when the government finally settled it, well, the personal computer had arrived. IBM didn't look so invincible anymore. It no longer controlled 90% of the market. And the government regulators sort of shrugged their shoulders and said, well, maybe we had the right case in the early 1970s, but by the mid-1980s, it's not even clear what we're doing with this case anymore. Perhaps the most interesting irony to come out of that was that just a few years later, IBM underwent a big reorganization. And the person who reorganized IBM, their new CEO, said, you know, what we really need at IBM is to break up IBM into separate divisions that will compete with each other in the market. So about 6 or 7 years after the antitrust people said, wow, we're just going to leave IBM alone, IBM reached a decision that it was important for the company to break itself up. Now, that plan to break itself up has sort of gone back and forth over time, but it's precisely, in a way, what the government regulators had proposed, breaking up IBM into separate divisions and having the divisions compete with each other rather than having one big company. It might actually have been good for IBM if the government regulators had succeeded in doing that somewhat earlier. The case of AT&T is somewhat different. Going back in the 1920s and 1930s, AT&T was given a monopoly power over America's phone system, both local and long distance. However, the antitrust authorities decided in the 1970s and early 1980s that now it was technologically possible to break up the phone company into different chunks and to have more competition than had existed before. So AT&T was broken up in several different ways. It was broken up locally into 7 companies that were called Baby Bell companies, which are sort of the local phone companies spread throughout the country. Then AT&T itself was carved off as a long-distance company, which had to compete with MCI and Sprint and other long-distance companies. And Bell Labs, the research arm of AT&T, was broken off into yet another company. It's interesting, if you go back and read at the time things that were written and said about that AT&T breakup, the typical kind of thing that was said by people who thought this was a terrible idea was, how is the U.S. ever going to compete now that we've broken up this big company? It means Japan is going to take over the telecommunications markets. There were predictions that, for example, as many as 30% of the U.S. population would no longer be able to afford telephone service because we would fall so far behind technologically after we'd broken up AT&T. One person said breaking up AT&T was like taking apart a 747 which was in the air and expecting the parts to keep on flying. Well, all those predictions look pretty silly somewhat later. As a result of the breakup of AT&T, the U.S. has more phone competition than most other countries in the world. Not all countries, but most other countries. It has lower phone rates than most other countries in the world. And it's a leader in telecommunications technology because all those small phone companies now had an incentive to go out there and come up with new ways of serving people, new kinds of products, new kinds of systems. It used to be, if you can remember back that far, that you could have any phone you wanted as long as the color was black. Heck, now you can have a phone that talks to you out of your personal computer. There have been enormous changes in the telecommunications markets in the last decade or so, and a lot of them probably trace back to the breakup of AT&T. Perhaps the most famous antitrust case of the 1990s looks set to be the case involving Microsoft. Microsoft has a monopoly, or close to a monopoly, in the basic operating systems that run computers. Now, having a monopoly in and of itself is not illegal. There's nothing wrong with having a monopoly as long as you get it by building up your product over time. And that's certainly what Microsoft did. They built up a product over time. What's wrong with a monopoly, or what you can be accused of as a monopoly, is using your monopoly power to drive out competitors. The particular accusations against Microsoft are that when they were competing with a firm called Netscape, both of which make browsers for going out on the internet, that Microsoft said to Netscape, or said to other companies, you don't put Netscape on your computers. You don't put Netscape on your computers because if you put Netscape on your computers, we won't let you use our system. So rather than competing by having the best product, the cheapest product, the accusation is that Microsoft was competing by threatening firms to withhold their monopoly product unless they punished the competition. Now, that may seem sort of an interesting competitive tactic. Again, there's nothing wrong with that sort of tactic if you don't have a monopoly. But if you do have a monopoly, then it's considered tying your products together and an abuse. I'm not sure quite how the Microsoft case will come out. At an extreme, we could imagine Microsoft being broken up into chunks, the way AT&T was broken up into chunks. Or we could imagine Microsoft being forced to take its patents and license them out to whoever wants them, so that there would be more competition, but Microsoft would still be the main producer of its particular products. There are a variety of different solutions the government could think about imposing. But right now, the accusations seem relatively small time against Microsoft, and I suspect that in the end, some long-term negotiated solution will work out, and it will probably be like the IBM case, that by the time everything is resolved, it will seem so outdated that we'll tend to look back and wonder what a lot of the fuss was about. So when we think about antitrust, what we think about is how much competition is there in the market, and can firms coming together in that market break up competition? Can they separate themselves? Can there enough of them competing to help provide that force that will hold prices down? And it's up to the government to try and make sure that to the extent possible, that's true. Another option that government has in terms of thinking about regulation and competition is to deregulate certain industries. Starting in the 1930s and up until the 1970s, there were a large number of industries which were heavily regulated by the federal government. These included airlines, banking, trucking, oil, natural gas, as well as like long-distance telephone service and some of these other companies that we just talked about. It's interesting that there was a big push for deregulating these companies, which actually took place under President Jimmy Carter, with the assistance of Ted Kennedy, a Democratic president and a certified liberal, both of them recognizing that we had gotten to a point with regulation of those industries where we weren't really helping the consumer anymore. Instead, we were facing a situation of regulatory capture, as we talked about that term before, where the regulators were really stopping new competition from coming in. And by stopping it from coming in, we're meaning that competition wasn't benefiting consumers anymore. In fact, there had been no new airlines at all for about 40 years, from the late 1930s up into the late 1970s. Perhaps even more disturbing or strange, the government controlled the prices of all flights that went between states, but they didn't control prices that were within states. And so certain large states, like Texas and California, had competition inside the state, even though they didn't have competition that went across state boundaries. If you looked at those states which had airline competition inside the state, you noticed immediately that their fares were about half as much per mile flown as flying between states. A pretty clear bit of evidence that you could fly a lot cheaper, it just wasn't happening under the current level of federal regulation. So, again, under a Democratic president with a liberal congressman, Ted Kennedy, in charge, they went ahead and deregulated many, many of those industries. The gains for consumers from that deregulation run into tens of billions of dollars a year, according to various economic estimates. In other words, what you pay for your airline ticket to your bank, for trucking services indirectly, through what you pay for goods, for oil and gas, all of those things are just tens of billions of dollars cheaper than they would have been if we hadn't deregulated. There's also been, of course, a lot of chaos. There have been airlines which came and went. It started and folded. Do you remember an airline called People Express a long time ago? It was a great way to fly for a very short time. And a lot of other companies have come and gone as well. But, you know, there's nothing about capitalism that guarantees stability. In fact, capitalism is really about an ongoing process of change and an ongoing process of evolution. So that deregulation freed up competition, benefited consumers a great deal, and really shook up those industries in a big way. There is, however, one case where you really can't break up the company, and also it's very difficult to think about just deregulating it. And that's the case known as a natural monopoly. What does it mean to say natural monopoly? What does the word natural mean in that case? Well, this is a case where breaking up and deregulation really won't work. And the reason it won't work is because the company has a particular kind of problem or a particular kind of industry. If you have an industry or a firm that works this way, as the scale of the industry goes up and up, that is, as the firm itself gets bigger and bigger, the average cost goes down and down. That is to say, if there are economies of scale, so that as you produce at a bigger and bigger scale, your average cost gets cheaper and cheaper, then it's going to be very hard for competition to work. Think about what happens for a moment if you look at the possible options here. Imagine you have a very big company, it's using its economies of scale, and as a result of using its economies of scale, it's producing at low average cost. If you break that company in half into two smaller companies, then those companies won't be able to take advantage of the economies of scale. They won't be able to produce as cheaply. And if they're not able to produce as cheaply, then everyone's going to end up paying higher prices because you broke up the company. Similarly, if you deregulate the company, if you don't have any regulation at all, then the company's a monopoly. If the company's a monopoly without any competition, then it can raise its prices and everyone ends up paying higher prices and they don't benefit. So how do we deal with the situation of large firms that have large economies of scale? Some examples of things like this will give you an idea of how we've dealt with it in the past. Typically, an example of a firm where as it gets bigger and bigger, the average costs go down and down, a standard example might be something like garbage collection. Imagine, for example, that you had a situation where everyone individually went out and bought garbage services from a whole bunch of different companies. And as a result, the garbage trucks, when they went down the street in the morning, would maybe stop at this house, and then they'd stop 6 houses down, and then they'd stop 10 houses down, and maybe in this neighborhood they only have one person on that block, and then they drive over and pick up garbage somewhere else. If you have that happening all over town, that's clearly not a very efficient way of picking up garbage. It's going to be a lot more efficient to have the truck just roll down the street, picking up the garbage at each stop on the way. Similarly, if you think about something like providing water or gas service, if every water company has to own its own pipes, and everyone gets water from different companies, then you might have to have 5 or 6 or 7 different sets of water pipes flowing through a city, and everyone would tap into whichever pipe they wanted. Well, having 6 or 7 sets of water pipes, or 6 or 7 sets of electrical wires, or 6 or 7 sets of garbage trucks going around, or 6 or 7 sets of phone lines, is simply not going to be an efficient way to proceed. In those cases, you've got a network, you want to have one good reliable network that covers everybody. So, if you've got that kind of situation where it doesn't make sense to have a whole lot of different companies competing, what are we going to do? How are we going to deal with that problem in a way that will help consumers get low prices, help have some competition, help use market forces, but at the same time not get too involved in just subsidizing companies? Well, I can tell you the old-time answer to this problem. The old-time answer was, let's do what's now known as cost-plus regulation. And cost-plus regulation typically worked this way. You set up some kind of a board or agency, and the board or agency would look at the phone company or at the electrical company or at the water company, and they would say, okay, we're a monopoly. We know you have to be a monopoly because you're a natural monopoly. We don't want to have a situation where we've got 6 different sets of pipes or 6 different sets of wire. So we know that you need to be a monopoly, but we're going to regulate you so you don't make too much money. Well, how can we regulate you so you don't make too much money? Well, here's how we'll do it. We'll look at all your costs. We'll see what all the costs are of the company. And then we'll tack on a certain amount of profit, say 8%. And that will guarantee that you don't make any more than 8% profit. So we'll guarantee that you make a certain profit, but we're not going to let you take advantage of your monopoly position. At first glance, that sounds fairly plausible, I think. But if you think about it for a moment more, if you think about the incentives involved in this particular plan, it almost immediately gets to be kind of a strange way of doing business. Think about it for a moment. If someone said to you, no matter how much you spend, whatever you spend, we'll give you that amount, your costs, plus an 8% return. Well, what do you do in that setting? It's fairly obvious. Spend as much as you can. Because the more you spend, the more your 8% is going to be at the end of the day. So what you were essentially doing with cost plus regulation was giving companies a big incentive to invest lots and lots of money in huge power plants or huge water plants or huge anything, just so they could get their costs up as much as possible. You, of course, don't want to give people an incentive to make their costs as high as possible. So what's the alternative? If we say that we do need to regulate to some extent, we do need to keep things under control, we can't just let natural monopolies run amok, but we don't want to guarantee them a certain rate of profit, how can we set things up so that it will work out and the incentives will work better? Well, one possibility which has been used quite well, say, in garbage collection, is an option for contracting out. And the way it might work is this way. Imagine that you've got a big city, and you're talking about collecting garbage in this big city, you break up the city into chunks. Maybe chunks of, 10,000 homes each. So these are pretty darn good sized chunks. Then you open the floor to bidding. And you say to garbage companies, hey, you come in and you give us a bid on what it will take for you to collect garbage from each of these neighborhoods. You let them bid on all the different neighborhoods, and then you let them choose. You choose whichever is the low bidder in the different neighborhoods. Now, the advantage of this, of course, is that the garbage companies are all competing with each other, but they're not competing in a way where they're going to have to skip down the block, getting from one house and then five houses later and then 10 houses later. They're competing to provide the service to the entire part of the city. Then the city can look at the different companies, see what's happening, see that they have some incentives to try and do better because they'll make more money if they can deliver more efficiently. If you have a company that's providing lousy service, well, don't hire them. But you have the possibility through that kind of contracting out and competition to bring some competition into that service in a way that will certainly help over time. And it will help provide some incentives of competition for lower costs and higher quality. A second option is sometimes called price cap regulation, which is different than cost plus regulation. The idea of price cap regulation works like this. I'll choose an example from a few years ago. The phone company in California used this kind of regulation. Phone company said, okay, here's the deal. For the next 5 years, we guarantee that our prices will go down 5% per year. That's what we guarantee. Now, if we can cut our costs by more than 5% a year, we're going to make money on this. No question about it. On the other hand, if we can't reduce our costs by more than 5% a year, then we're stuck. We won't make as much money as we expect. Now think about the incentives of that sort of proposal for a moment, which again has to be negotiated with an agency, a public commission, which would oversee this and see whether the figure seemed reasonable. The company has a substantial incentive to say, okay, now we're going to have to go down 5% every year. We better figure out ways to provide phone service more cheaply and more efficiently to everyone who's out there. And so they have incentives to push down the price as much as they can. Then, after 5 years, the Public Utility Commission comes back and renegotiates. The Public Utility Commission comes back and says, okay, actually over those 5 years, you pushed costs down by 50%. That's great. Now we're starting fresh. And we're starting at the current level that you're at, and we're going to make you push down costs again by larger amounts. So instead of trying to say, here are your costs, we guarantee you a profit, price cap regulation says, we're going to set a price cap. And if you can beat that price cap, good for you. And if you can't beat that price cap, bad for you. But it's really up to you. And we're going to try and use that to bring forth an incentive to do more innovation and to provide services more efficiently. When we think about this notion of regulating monopolies and how we deal with monopolies, I guess the bottom line at the end of the day is that where possible, you want to have competition because competition works well. So where possible, we want to deregulate. We want to get away from the government setting prices and setting quantities and telling airlines where they can fly. We want to get away from the issues of specifically saying, okay, we'll give you cost plus. We want to get away from government even being involved in antitrust more than it needs to. But we're also saying with all of that that government really does have a role to play in this. And that as Pareto and Adam Smith and a lot of other great economists have said, that if you just let businessmen alone, they will tend to try and figure out a way that they can band together and charge monopoly profits. And if we want to avoid that happening, what we've got to do is figure out some ways to encourage more competition out there in the market. A second big problem, shift the ground for a little bit, a second big problem in markets is to think about information problems and information problems that affect buyers and sellers in markets. In general, we started off this set of lectures by talking about cases where exchange benefited both parties. And that was good stuff. But remember that exchange only benefits both parties if we assume that both sides know what's going on. And you can't always assume that in the market. In fact, in cases where both sides don't know what's going on, where information is somewhat imperfect, you can end up with some very odd situations. For example, as an example that goes back a couple decades to an economist named George Akerlof, think about this situation. You go to a market to buy a used car. You've got in your mind what car you want to get, what make and model and year, and you know roughly what you need to pay for it. But let's say you're no expert on cars, so you know your information is imperfect. You go to the car lot, and let's say you see two versions of this car sitting side by side. They both look about the same to you. One of them costs just about what you were expecting to pay. The other one costs half as much. Half as much. Big shock. Half as much. Would you buy the cheaper car? To you, they look identical. And the sort of simple economics logic would say, hey, they look identical, buy the cheap one. But a slightly more sophisticated logic, a human logic, if you will, would say, whoa, there's a reason that one is really cheap. Now, you may not know what that reason is because your information is imperfect, but there is a reason that that one is cheap. And if you buy that car, you're going to be buying a low car, a low quality lemon, which is likely to break down on you in a short period of time. And so a lot of people would say, I don't think I'm going to get that low price car. It's too low. It's too low in a way that makes me queasy and uncomfortable in my stomach. So I'm not going to do it. That same problem can arise in other markets as well. Imagine you were running a business and you're paying most of your workers, $12, $13 an hour. And someone shows up at your office and says, wow, I really want to work here. I'll work for $6 an hour. Do you hire that person? Or do you say, if they're willing to work for $6 an hour, I'm a little worried about what kind of worker they are. They may not be as good as the people I've got now. And since I don't know that person, I'm not just going to hire them immediately. That low price worries me. Or if you were a banker and someone came to you and said, hey, I understand you're charging 10% for loans. Well, I really want this loan a lot, so I'll pay you 20%. Would you say, oh, gee, great, somebody who's willing to pay me 20%? Or would you say, whoa, this person sounds like a crazy gambler to me. I bet if I loan them my money, I don't see the 20%, I probably won't even see the money again. So in any of these situations where you're not quite sure about the quality of the car, the quality of the worker, the quality of the borrower, where you don't have good information about those things, you have to begin to worry about whether the price system is working very well in sorting things out. How can the government deal with these problems of setting up situations where information will be better? Well, the most obvious thing you can do is require disclosure. Require companies to disclose information. And, for example, we have laws that require that the ingredients of products be written on the side of the package. We have laws that advertisements can't be deceptive. And we enforce those laws to some extent. If you invest in something, they have to send you a little portfolio thing that tells you all about what the conditions of the investment are. There are some wonderful examples in the industrial relations literature of cases that have been won by the government where people were using deceptive advertising of one sort or another. One of my favorites is a case of a soup company. I won't name the company, I will just say they make good soup, which was sued a few years ago because they were showing an advertisement on television for their soup, which was vegetable soup. And when you looked at it in the ad, you saw that the vegetables were like heaping up out of the bowl. They came rising up out of the soup. And then when you actually bought the can of soup, when you poured it in your bowl, the vegetables are sort of floating around in the soup, but they're certainly not heaping up in any big way. So what was going on there? Well, it turned out that what the company was doing was they were putting a lot of marbles in the bottom of the bowl and then pouring the soup over the top so that the vegetables were piled up out of the bowl. That is deceptive advertising. You're not allowed to do it. More recently, Volvo was sued at one point because they had an ad which showed a monster truck crashing over various cars. So this monster truck would sort of drive up to the first car and the roof would cave in, and drive up to the next car and the roof would cave in, drive onto the next car, the roof would cave in, then it gets to the Volvo. And it goes right over the top of the Volvo, nothing happens, hits the next car, the roof caves in. Obviously the message, Volvos are much stronger, safer cars. Well, it turned out that the reason the Volvo didn't cave in like the other cars was they had reinforced it inside with plywood so that it could hold the weight of the monster truck. And otherwise it would have caved in just like the other cars. That kind of deceptive advertising is clearly illegal and clearly should be illegal. You don't want to be able to just lie about stuff in a factual kind of way. Now, of course, you might argue, in a broader kind of way, isn't all advertising really kind of lying? I mean, does anyone really believe that if you were to drink a certain kind of caffeinated cola beverage, that you'll be smarter, brighter, sweeter, and better loved? Probably not. But there are certain kinds of exaggeration which are allowed, as long as it doesn't shade into claims about safety or nutrition or about what you're actually getting. The big problem where information comes up as an even bigger difficulty, and one that's much harder to solve, is in markets for insurance. And insurance markets are worth a little bit of thought because there's so many public policy issues surrounding them now. Insurance markets should work by sharing risk. One way to think about an insurance market, for example, is just think about a million people. And let's say that there's a 1% chance that any one of these million people is going to have a fire in their house. So, all million people chip in, pay some insurance, and those who randomly get hit by the fire at the end of the year, they get paid, so they don't end up losing money. Insurance is just a way of sharing risk across a large group. Now, two problems immediately arise if you think about this broad and fairly simple scenario. First of all, if you have people who have insurance, they tend to behave differently than people who don't have insurance. Though really, they tend to be more willing to take risks. If you have insurance against fire damage, then you might be more willing not to worry quite as much about fire. I remember a friend of mine a few years ago, we were out at a movie, and when we got back from the movie, it turned out that someone had clipped the rear end of his car and sort of caved in the back taillight. They'd left him a little note with their insurance number and everything. Well, I remember my friend is dancing around his car. He's incredibly happy that he got hit. Because he said, hey, now I can have the whole thing repainted, and the insurance will pay for it. If you have insurance, you think differently than if you don't have insurance. You're more willing to have things like that happen to you. And the insurance company, you figure, is going to chip in and pay for them. That problem is what economists call moral hazard. That if you are insured, then you take more risks. It may be a little bit immoral to take more risks. That's why the name moral hazard. But you're certainly willing to do it. It's probably not just coincidence that when certain areas of the city get into bad shape, you tend to see more fires there. It's probably not always arson or something terrible like that. It's just that, hey, the building's insured. I'm not going to worry too much about it. If it happens to burn, hey, no big deal. And that kind of attitude of stepping away from minimizing the risk changes what's going on in the insurance market. It might be, for example, that in our original example, they might have a million people of whom 1% are going to have a fire if they don't have any insurance. But as soon as they have insurance, now maybe 1.5% or 2% of them are all of a sudden going to claim that they were damaged by a fire and that they need to be paid off by insurance. The other difficulty in insurance markets, besides moral hazard, is called adverse selection. The difficult part of adverse selection is that any company that in this group of a million people, some people are likely to have a fire and some people aren't. Let me think about this instead of fires by talking about safe drivers. Imagine you have a million drivers. Now, some of those drivers are very safe and they know they're very safe. Some of those drivers are very risky and they know they're very risky. If you just set one average insurance rate right in the middle of that group, what you'll find is that the risky drivers are delighted. They're like, hey, this is great. I get really cheap insurance, even though I have an accident every 3 months. On the other hand, the safe drivers are going to be really grumpy. They'll be saying, why do I have to pay this much for insurance? After all, I haven't had an accident in the last 15 years. So what will happen in that case in a competitive market? What will happen is that companies will go into the market and they will try and insure only the safe drivers. They'll try and steer away or get rid of those people who are more likely to have accidents, who are more likely to have problems. That same thing will happen in all kinds of insurance markets. You try and avoid people who are likely to have a fire. If you're selling health insurance, you try and avoid people who are likely to get sick. So if you're trying to avoid folks on one side and on the other side, then you have to say, well, you're going to have a problem of adverse selection. Adverse selection meaning that those who really need the insurance, because they have high risk, aren't going to be able to buy it. They're going to get screened out. And the people who end up getting the insurance are going to be the safe risks, which hardly need it at all. Insurance markets operate in a lot of different areas. There's auto insurance, homeowners insurance, health insurance, fire insurance, workman's compensation insurance, unemployment insurance. Whatever kind of insurance you're talking about, these problems of moral hazard and adverse selection come up over and over and over again. And they both represent reasons why it's difficult for insurance markets to work well. The losses or the payments tend to go up, because people claim a lot more losses when they've got insurance. And adverse selection means that we're always leaving out part of the market and trying to give insurance to those who don't really need it. Health insurance is perhaps the most vivid example in the last few years in our public dialogue where these problems have come up. Obviously, the problem with moral hazard in health insurance is when you have health insurance, you go in and you get the extra checkup, you get the extra test, you get the extra pills, you get the extra everything. Nothing wrong with that one thing at a time, but the fact that you have insurance makes the cost a lot higher than it would otherwise be. And you just have to face that as a reality. That's the moral hazard problem. Insurance helps drive up healthcare costs in that way. We also have the adverse selection problem. The adverse selection problem is that people who are really ill, people who might have AIDS or might have cancer or might have some terrible disease, just can't buy health insurance. And a lot of people don't have health insurance for other reasons as well. So some people end up with health insurance, other people can't afford it even though they're sick and they really need it. The result, in a lot of cases, is that we're operating in a market where neither side of the market, neither buyers nor sellers, has a lot of full information. If you're a patient, you don't really know what's good medicine or bad medicine. You can try and read up as best you can, but you don't have a medical degree. You're going to have a hard time sorting those things out. Moreover, a lot of the time your employer is providing your health insurance, so you don't even see the real cost. You're buying something where you don't really know the cost, and you don't really know how to judge whether it's what you need or not. On the flip side of the market, it's always nice to say that doctors really know what's going on. But a lot of doctors, because of health insurance, don't need to know very much about the costs of what's going on. They can sort of say, hey, the costs are the insurance company's problem. Moreover, a lot of doctors, I think, they know a lot, but they don't know everything. There are an awful lot of cases in medical practice where if you look at different cities, you find that doctors in one city do a lot of tonsillectomies, a lot of hysterectomies, a lot of heart transplants, and doctors in some other city don't do nearly as many. And there doesn't seem any big difference in health between the two cities. It's just that doctors are in different habits in one city than in another city. Well, if you've got a situation where the buyers, the patients, don't have much information or cost consciousness, and the sellers, the doctors, have more information but still not perfect information and don't have much cost consciousness, you've got to expect that situation is going to have a lot of difficulties. Estimates in the U.S. economy are now that of the $1 trillion or so each year that we spend on health care, perhaps a third of it gives no particular medical benefit. It's simply extra stuff added on because no one needs to be so cost conscious in the system. We've also got perhaps 35 or 40 million people who don't even have any health insurance. So we're providing a lot of care, which doesn't seem to be helping people, while not providing care to some others whom it might help. This isn't the place or the moment to try and fix the entire U.S. healthcare system, but I do think that if we're going to think about fixing it, we need to think about making the costs and benefits more transparent and getting them more out front for people. We need to make clear to people, what are you actually paying for health insurance, or what is your employer paying on your behalf? We need to expand our studies and do government research and development of what works and at what cost, and get that information spread around more among doctors. We need to think about having pressure for institutions to think about studying these kinds of issues. We need to say to insurance companies, no, you don't get to just skim off the healthy people and not provide any insurance for the sick people. You have to cover large groups. And in those groups, there will be some good risks and some bad risks, but we're not going to let adverse selection run wild. Now, all those problems are terribly controversial. People don't like being told that their health insurance has a cost. People don't like being told that we need to bring some cost consciousness into the system. People say all the time things like, well, is it about health or is it about money? And you sort of think, well, it's about both. You really have to take both into account. You can't just spend money and pretend that it's not spending something. You need to think about providing health, but also having some limits and some realistic ideas about what will work and what won't work. In the very first lecture, I said that economists were serious about incentives and trade-offs. And at that point, I probably sounded like a pretty conservative kind of guy. There's always trade-offs. You always need to worry about them. But I hope that in the last few lectures, what I've managed to argue is that markets have their problems too. They have a variety of problems in information, in antitrust, in competition, in poverty, in inequality, in positive and negative externalities. And that in all of those cases, government has at least a possible role to play. It has a role to play in setting up the rules where things operate. It has a role to play as a referee in settling disputes. And it has a role to play in terms of giving some incentives to counterbalance some of the things that would be going on in a free market. I sometimes think it's useful, when you're upset with a market, to try and think in a serious way about what it is that's really upsetting you. For example, if you're upset with the market and you don't like the market outcome, are you upset because the market is working or because it's not working? It may be that the market is working perfectly well, but that you just don't like what's being produced, or you'd like the price to be lower, or you'd like the quantity to be higher. If that's true, then we can go back to the examples like affordable housing and helping farmers that we talked about back in Lecture 3, and use tools of supply and demand to subsidize or to tax either the demand or the supply side of the market, and move supply and demand so that they're more in a place we would like to have them. But in other cases, we would say the market is breaking down. These cases of externalities, these cases of poverty and inequality, these cases of information failure and antitrust. In those particular cases, what we want to do is say, what's the problem? How we identified the problem? And then focus in on a particular solution. If the problem's a negative externality, think about a pollution tax. If it's a positive externality, think about the appropriate subsidy. If the problem is poverty, think about how we encourage wage subsidies. If the problem is inequality, think about redistribution or ladders of opportunity. If the problem is antitrust, think about deregulation or breaking up the firm. Think about regulating the natural monopoly. And in each of those cases, the economic way of thinking, the structure of economic thinking, leads us through to a very particular kind of solution. Again, the goal is not to throw aside the market. We certainly always have to remember that the market, that huge force of nature, is out there. When particular problems arise, we can diagnose them and then deal with them accordingly.
I'm Tom Rollins, president of the Teaching Company. Thank you for listening to these lectures from the Superstar Teachers series. We hope you enjoyed them as much as we did. To receive a copy of our latest catalog or to order more courses, please give us a call at 1-800-TEACH-12. That's 1-800-TEACH-12.